Hello and welcome to ID the Future. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting with Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture in Seattle, Washington. On today's episode, we have once again with us Dr. Richard Sternberg, an evolutionary biologist with interests in the relationship between genes and morphological homologies and the nature of genomic information. Dr. Sternberg has two PhDs, one in biology molecular evolution from Florida International University and another in systems science from Binghamton University. He's a former staff scientist at the National Center for Biotechnology Information and also was a research associate at the Smithsonian's National Museum for Natural History. So, Dr. Sternberg, thank you for coming back on the show with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
So we are talking about the origin and evolution of whales. And the occasion that brings you back on the show here with us, Dr. Sternberg, of course, is a new documentary that was recently released by Illustre Media titled Living Waters, Intelligent Design in the Oceans of the Earth. And this documentary talks about whether or not whales are in fact this sort of poster child for macroevolution, as it's often claimed by evolutionists. We often will see pictorial portrayals of these supposed transitional fossils showing intermediate stages between land mammals and whales, supposedly showing how whales evolved from land mammals. And in the previous podcast, we talked about some of these supposed transitional fossils with Dr. Sternberg, as well as how much time is available in the fossil record to go from a land mammal to a whale, and then some of the many features that would be necessary to evolve, the morphological and physiological traits that would be necessary to evolve from a land mammal to a whale. So, Dr. Sternberg, this sort of tees up the question now. Is there enough time for all of these traits to evolve in the 8 to 9 million years that are available in the fossil record to go from a full-fledged land mammal to a fully aquatic whale? So can you talk to us about the problem or whether this poses a problem for Darwinian evolution?
Yes. The short answer is that I do not think 8 to 9 million years was enough time for the emergence of the Bathysaurid and later the modern whales by a standard neo-Darwinian mechanism. Now, that does not mean that necessarily this is a scenario of intelligent design. I would not make that argument. I do not think that a standard population genetics account, that is where you have a succession of gene variants entering a population or leaving a population or lineage, followed by the fixation or lack thereof in that lineage, I don't think that's an adequate explanation. I do not question the fossil record, nor do I question the accepted phylogenetic sequence from Pachycetus to Bathysaurus or Dorudon. What I do question is the models that are assumed by many to be adequate to explain that sequence of transitions. What you have to keep in mind is that there are four aspects of the neo-Darwinian model. And by that, I mean any population genetics model. So I equate neo-Darwinism with population genetics. And they can be summarized in actuarial terms. It involves birth and or death of gene variants, the emigration and or immigration of gene variants by the individuals that are competent to breed leaving a population or entering a population. It's commonly cast as you need the introduction of genetic variation, and then that genetic variation is winnowed by the creative force that is natural selection. So let me expand on this, if I may, to highlight the problems. If you assume, as some may, that there was just plenty of genetic variation in the earliest ancestors of the fully aquatic cetaceans, you run into a problem when you're dealing with mammals. And that problem has been highlighted by the work of Michael Lynch, who's a population geneticist. The problem is this. In order for natural selection to have traction, so to speak, in a lineage, there had to have been what are called breeding population sizes or effective population sizes that are on the order of 10 to the 8th, 10 to the 9th individuals per generation, a mean number of individuals. What do I mean by that? Well, what I mean is that if you take a standard mammalian population and you look at the number of individuals, adults that are actually contributing to the next generation or could contribute to the next generation, what you find is that even with the most successful mammals, the breeding population sizes fall far below 10 to the 8th, 10 to the 9th individuals on average. What this means is that natural selection cannot get traction with such breeding population sizes. They're too small. And that leaves the other possibility for genetic change over time. That is by drift or near neutral mode. Now, what does that mean, drift or near neutral mode? Well, it means that if you have some advantageous gene variant, say one that makes having or contributes to having, say, a ball vertebra, it can be, despite the beneficial nature, the adaptive value of that particular variant, it can be fixed in a population or it can be lost in a population over time with equal probability. Conversely, there may be some deleterious gene variant, say one that if you utilize isovaleric acid, it's either being produced or it's being gathered from the environment and deposited in the mandibular fat pad. Well, let's say it leads to sickness. It's not a beneficial gene variant. Well, again, if drift or near neutral mode of evolution is at play, there's an equal probability that deleterious variant will be either fixed in the population or lost. It's a truly an undirected mode of evolution. But that's what you get when you have low breeding population sizes, and we have no reason to think that along the lineage or lineages of the walking whales that they had breeding population sizes that were astronomical compared to the mammals that we know of today. So that's one problem. If you say, well, yes, they had just a lot of variation, and that variation was being produced by the recombination of gene variants that does indeed produce most genetic variability in a lineage, or if you have gene variants that were arising by the breeding population so that you just had, if you will, a large quote-unquote gene pool of variation, you run into the problem that unless the breeding population sizes were quite large, you cannot invoke natural selection as a causative force. You're left with drift. So that's one problem. Another problem is that if, say, Pachycetus or some of the later walking whales did not have extensive genetic variability due to, say, small population sizes, then you have to invoke a mutational mechanism that will enable that variation to arise, the variation that resulted in such things as tail flukes and the neuromuscular modifications that enable, say, a blowhole to function or to reproduce underwater. If one supposes that, you just needed one mutation per gene to give such variability, then that is not so unlikely. The problem that arises is if you need, or if there had to have been, two or more coordinated changes of a genetic nature, then there simply was not enough time. For example, the countercurrent heat exchange system. We do know that there are mutations that arise that lead to testes not descending. Happens in humans, happens in mice, happens in a number of mammals. Leads to sterility, of course. So if you imagine that there had to have been some other genetic modification that enabled the countercurrent heat exchange system, that arterial venous plexus that I mentioned in an earlier podcast, there had to have been at least two or more coordinated genetic changes. I do not mean two mutations occurring at the same instance of time. What I mean is that you have a change, say, in one gene, a change in another gene, and in order to get some adaptive effect, those two variants have to come together in the same individual without necessarily those variants being fixed in the lineage. That is, there could be, you know, variability. Some individuals have that variant, some individuals don't. Well, we do have good estimates on the time it would take, and these were provided by Durrett and Schmidt in a paper published in Genetics in 2008. They were responding to the arguments made by Michael Behe in his book, The Edge of Evolution. And incidentally, they were trying to refute Behe's argument. The conclusion they reached, however, is quite striking. The waiting times for only two coordinated changes that are not fixed in a population, but that have to come together in order for there to be some effect on the form or the phenotype, as it's called, In the case of our lineage, the hominid lineage, it would have been a mere 216 million years. That's the waiting time. Now, remember, chimpanzee-human divergence from a common ancestor is set at 5.5 million years. If you want to turn the clock back to 216 million years, and that's their estimated waiting time, and it's an underestimate, it turns out, there was simply not enough time because of hominid breeding population sizes. If you want to turn to, say, bacteria, viruses, fruit flies, it's not so much of a problem. But in the case of mammals that have small breeding population sizes, it becomes a problem. Now, if you want to take that figure, 216 million years, and they based it on a generation time of 25 years for a hominid on average, and among other factors, and one would have to look at their paper to get the mathematical details. But if you translate that into what I call whale evolution time, where you have generational times on average of 5 years, then the waiting time for two coordinated changes to come together is about 43.3 million years. So 8 to 9 million years simply was not enough time. So I think that whether you opt for a model based on selection, if you opt for that and you're going to stick to that as an explanation, then you have to come up with some corollary with regard to breeding population sizes. Were they extremely large? That's doubtful. If you opt for a drift or near neutral model, then you have to explain how you have just a number of coordinated modifications appearing not only in a lineage, but in such a short period of time. And if you say, well, I'm going to assume that the transitions that we see, that rapid succession of body plans, was just as easy or just as facile a process as the evolution of fruit flies. You present an ad hoc but best case scenario that does not provide that much room for comfort, and here's why. You can take a study by M.K. Burke et al., published in Nature in 2010, where they looked at long-term evolution of laboratory fruit fly populations. They were looking at whether or not you indeed, over 600 generations, had the fixation of advantageous gene variants. Now, we're speaking of laboratory population where you can control things like temperature and feeding regimes and the like. But what they found was that even under those conditions, because there was variability in the selection regimes, that is, selection is not this uniform process that one might think, it can vary over time. It's a multivariable process. What they found was that you did not have these clean sweeps of the laboratory populations where the old gene variants were removed and replaced by the new gene variants. And that's, again, it's a problem because when you study the taxonomy of cetacea, you find that each species, each genus, each family has what are called diagnostic characters, meaning that you can identify a bottlenose dolphin or an orca or a gray whale with some confidence because they have certain traits that are unique to the species to which they belong. And that implies that the genetic substratum for those traits, what makes Tursiops truncatus, has been fixed in that particular lineage. That has to be explained. It is not explained, in my opinion, given the existing population genetic models and therefore given the existing neo-Darwinian models. It is not enough to see a sequence of forms in the geological record as indexed by time and to infer ancestor-descendant relationships and therefore conclude that a neo-Darwinian model must be correct. That is not correct at all. One can take the geological record, one can say, accept the phylogeny, starting from Pachycetus, ending with a blue whale, it doesn't matter, and still say, what is the best model to explain that phylogeny? And we do not have that model at hand. And if one wants to argue, as some have, like G. Gaylord Simpson and others, that, well, the solution would be small population sizes, really small population sizes in the past that enabled what was termed quantum evolution or genetic revolutions and the like. Well, you run into the problem. Drift is going to predominate. You may have genetic revolutions, but they may not necessarily be ones that will enable there to be innovations. Look at the Florida panther. There are a number of problems out there, and there are some paleontologists, some fossil whale experts who I think implicitly recognize that the standard model of incremental genetic changes being winnowed by natural selection or incremental genetic changes that accrete by some near-neutral mode simply is not going to explain the fossil record of whales.
So Dr. Sternberg, it really sounds like what you're saying is that essentially standard evolutionary models, whether we're talking about random mutation and natural selection or neutral drift or a combination thereof, they cannot account for the rapidity of the origin of whales that we see in the fossil record. And essentially these standard evolutionary models cannot explain what we see in the fossil record when it comes to the origin of whales.
Yes, I think that given the existing models that fall under the purview of neo-Darwinism, they are not adequate, in my opinion, to explain the sequence. There's no reason not to accept that there was ancestor-descendant relations. The question is, how did you get such striking morphological transformations? And in that order, in such a short period of time.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Sternberg, for this fascinating discussion. We're actually not quite done yet. We're going to do a third podcast with Dr. Sternberg about the origin and evolution of whales. In the meantime, you can learn a lot more about this topic by checking out the new documentary, Living Waters, Intelligent Design and the Oceans of the Earth. The website is livingwatersthefilm.com. And in that film, Dr. Sternberg spends quite a bit of time discussing the topic of the origin and evolution of whales and some of the problems with neo-Darwinian explanations in great detail with some wonderful animated sequences to explain what he's arguing, what he's talking about. So again, check out the new film from Illustra Media, Living Waters, Intelligent Design and the Oceans of the Earth. I'm Casey Luskin with ID the Future. Stay tuned for more with Dr. Richard Sternberg. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2015. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.